The COVID-19 pandemic has thrown nursing education and the NCLEX exam into an unknown and confusing moment. Let's talk all about the impact and repercussions on this special bonus episode of The Nurse Keith Show. Hey there, this is Nurse Keith. In these days of the COVID-19 pandemic, we're disseminating as much high-quality, evidence-based information and expert opinion about the situation as we can in our special bonus COVID-19 episodes. Meanwhile, we still want to support you in your nursing career, your personal development, and even your nursing education. So please enjoy this interview that touches on the pandemic in a very specific way. Be well, stay safe, many blessings on you, your loved ones, your colleagues, your communities, and everyone on this troubled yet beautiful planet of ours. And we are here. Hello and welcome to the Nurse Keith Show. I'm privileged to have the opportunity to use this platform to educate and inform you, the Nurse Keith Nation, so that you can take any information you find useful and share it with those you care about the most. I'm committed to regularly publishing these episodes related to the COVID-19 pandemic. These episodes are always free of corporate sponsorship and advertising of any of my stuff. This is solely about education and information as a public service. Please share far and wide if you feel these episodes are a valuable approach to the virus. Remember that the show notes for this episode can be found at nursekeith.com/nursingeducation. Now, I am welcoming to the pod, friend of the pod, Damian Keith Jenkins from thenursespeak.com. And Damian, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure seeing you here on Skype and looking at your adorable face.
Thank you.
You're my good friend. We've met at the National Nurses of Business Association, and we've hung out a bit.
Yep.
Hanging out in Vegas.
Yeah.
And this year, we're not going to be hanging out in Vegas.
But doesn't look that way.
No, it doesn't look that way. So you're a master's prepared registered nurse. You're a writer. You're a public speaker. And one of the things two of the things you also do is you're a nurse educator at the bachelor's level, I believe, right?
So I've actually taught the master's level and below, but more recently, my experience has been with staff development. So, you know, making sure all of the new employees and current employees are maintaining their competence and growing professionally and moving up the ladder.
And where is that? Where does that happen?
So that was at LifeBridge Health in Baltimore, which is a big hospital group.
That's yep. Right. Okay. And then you're also an NCLEX preparation expert at thenursespeak.com.
That is
you
correct.
And I've talked about this stuff before, and you help new graduate nurses pass the NCLEX. And I believe your customers, your clients have a pretty high pass rate, don't they?
So 4 years and running, I'm still holding on to 100%.
Woohoo. Okay. Yeah. Kudos.
Thank you.
Virtual high five. So, all right. So you know a lot about nursing education.
I do.
And you know a lot about nurse testing, about the NCLEX, and you're an NCLEX expert.
Yes.
So Damian, what the heck is going on with nursing education in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic in April of 2020? Can you first just give us a synopsis? What the heck is going on?
Sure. So part of my experience as an academic nurse educator had landed me into being the academic affiliations coordinator at the facility that I work at with LifeBridge Health. And so I've stayed in, you know, connection with the academic side of nursing education because I'm the main person that the schools go through in order to get their students in clinical placement so they can complete their hours, whether it's clinical groups where an instructor will come or whether the person comes to the facility to do a one-to-one practicum. And so obviously, when everything was happening and the schools were scrambling to figure out how are they still going to get their students the clinical experience that they need to graduate on time, because that's the biggest requirement that they were concerned about.
Yes.
It was kind of chaotic because some schools were deciding to just pull students all together and say they'll figure out later. Some schools were trying to partner with the facilities to see how they could continue the practicum. And then we've all seen just how the different nursing organizations, the ANA, NLN, and other big organizations kind of were trying to figure out ways to allow nursing students the clinical experience, but maybe up the incentive, for instance, by having hospitals hire the nursing students and letting them practice at the bedside without a license, but under the direct supervision of licensed nurses. And so there was a lot of different...
Like as a CNA, kind of?
Kind of, but still more focused on the role of the nurse. So maybe that the nursing student could provide some respite for the more routine tasks for the nurses, not that initial assessment, not the nursing judgment type thing, but more or less like routine skills, like a Foley insertion or, you know, like wound care or, you know, the, you know, maybe passing routine medications, nothing high risk or nothing narcotic.
And as an unlicensed healthcare person, staff member.
Right.
Now, is that happening anywhere that you're aware of?
So to my knowledge, it has not been approved.
Anywhere.
So I think what has happened since that original proposal has not been officially approved. And if anyone knows that it has been, please let either me or Nurse Keith know so that we can update and give out the correct information. But what I know to be true is that there has been a push for nursing students to start working as CNAs at a minimum, so that we can have the extra all hands on deck.
Yes.
In addition to allowing them to use that time as clinical hours.
Now, is there only one organization who can actually approve nursing students doing this?
It's actually case by case, state by state.
I thought it would be more of a national decision.
It's not, because each state governs their scope of practice for nursing.
Oh.
So each state would have to agree to allow that to happen. And now, so the national organizations said, this is what we think should happen, but then it's still up to each state to decide, is that something they want to move forward with or not?
Okay, and the national organization is?
So there's several that put their hands in the pot. American Nurse Association, the National League for Nursing. There was, I think, the American Association for Critical Care Nurses. There was at least five or six that I remember reading this proposal, and that all of these people endorsed, all of these organizations endorsed this plan. But obviously it has to be approved at the state level.
But what about the certifying or accrediting bodies that accredit nursing schools? Don't they have to have a hand in this pot as well?
So interestingly enough,
yeah.
Typically the Board of Nursing is the one who accredits the program.
The State Board of Nursing.
Yeah, the schools themselves are accredited by the other kind of, you know, college certifying bodies and things like that. But specific to nursing, the boards of nursing get to choose the accreditation of the program.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
And I did not know that.
Yeah, so all curriculum for nursing schools has to be submitted to the State Board of Nursing for approval before they can be an accredited nursing program.
And the state boards of nursing then have to sign off on a nursing student working as a CNA before being licensed and passing the NCLEX.
Because they would be the ones processing that CNA certification.
I see. So, you know, I have friends whose daughters or sons are nursing students right now. I have a dear friend here in New Mexico whose daughter is going to school somewhere here in the United States. And she was in her, I guess it would have been her second semester of nursing school. Mm-hmm. And she's doing these online courses. A lot of it feels to her, I believe, like busy work. Mm-hmm. Like they're just trying to figure out what they can do. So they're throwing all this stuff at them. And which I understand, and I'm sure as an educator, you understand that has to happen. However, here's the question, and you and I spoke on the phone last week, I believe. We had a long talk. How are we going to make sure that these students get properly educated and then can actually pass an exam without maybe having all of the education and clinical experience they need to pass such exam? Mm-hmm. and then get them out into the workforce because we need them. Mm-hmm. How do we, like, what are the mechanisms to make that happen when we don't even know if they can go to school this summer or even next fall because COVID-19 might explode again in September and October?
Right.
So there must be a lot of contingency plans in place, but my worry, and I think yours might be too, is like, we need these people in the workforce. So
we
what
do.
Do we do?
Yeah, we do need them in the workforce. And so the expectation is still that they still meet all of the minimum requirements for determining their level of competency. And we know that the national standard for that is the NCLEX. So although schools of nursing can vary drastically in the way that they provide the nursing education, and I know this from experience from dealing with the vast amount of clients I've dealt with and hearing about the way that they were trained and even looking over syllabuses and course outlines that their schools had given them, and I could see the gaps or I can see the variance. They still have to pass that minimum standard. And I think they that do. that's not changing. They still have to get, you know, their license, and they still have to pass the NCLEX before they can start working as a licensed nurse. Same thing with the CNA. Some states allow, if you finish fundamentals and MedSurg 1, you're like your first year of nursing school, you automatically qualify to be a CNA. Some states don't have that. You know, some states don't authorize that, and then they make you take an additional course or an additional certification exam. But, you know, I'm more familiar with Maryland because that's where, you know, most of my nursing career and nursing education experience is. And Maryland does offer that, where after you finish that first year, you automatically qualify for your CNA, pending that you continue to maintain all of the requirements to keep that CNA. So even if someone doesn't finish nursing school, for instance, as long as they're still doing the hours, doing the continuing education, and they're not being reported as, you know, not doing things correctly, then they can keep their CNA certification and continue to work as a CNA.
And that's having done, in Maryland specifically, Fundamentals of Nursing and MedSurg 1.
Yeah, so that first year of nursing.
The first year. And then we know they've had A&P and chemistry and probably microbiology, possibly, and algebra and all that stuff.
Which is actually more than what a nursing assistant is required to do.
Oh, yeah, of course. Right. A nursing assistant doesn't do
any of that.
Two semesters of A&P and lab and all that. So, right. So they're overqualified as CNAs.
Exactly. Yeah. There are no prerequisites to be a CNA. And depending on the state, you know, they don't even have to have a high school diploma. They don't even have a reading level above the fifth grade level. So it really depends on the state.
Right. Okay. I hear that. I'm not sure about New Mexico. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah. So the minimum competency, you know, that measurement, the NCLEX or the certification exams, that's still happening. And I think what a lot of the nurse educators are doing on the academic side is that they are still measuring competence through the same assessments that they've been using. So they're still expecting for the same exams to be issued. Mm-hmm. They're still expecting for the students to be able to validate their skills. And so what I know a lot of schools have done is now they're just doing kind of how we are right now on Skype. So the student has to perform the skill in front of the webcam so that the instructor can see step by step that they're doing it correctly. I think the biggest challenge is getting the mannequins or the supplies and things like that to the students. So there might have to be a little bit of make-believe happening. But so long as the student can articulate the steps and go through the steps, then they're being given credit. So I know that's one thing that's happening at some of the schools that I've been speaking to. And then for like those practicum sessions, you know, they're really tuning into like virtual check-ins. So instead of you being on site all the time, which we're not allowing students on site because of COVID, we're doing those weekly or maybe two times a week check-ins virtually where we can run through the course objectives, make sure that they're speaking to the key points and that they're learning, and maybe set them up with examples so that they can do their assignments. Because with those one-to-one practicums, most of what it is collecting data and less, you know, doing hands-on, unless maybe it's a BSN practicum, then they do a lot of the hands-on stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the hardest places to get in the door right now is those one-to-one BS in practicums. But if you're thinking about like master's degree programs or DNP programs, we can definitely set them up with mentors who can check in with them, you know, once or twice a week and just make staying on course.
Yeah, I have a friend in a DNP program at Columbia right now. I think she's in her first year. And she's doing like virtual visits with her mentor preceptor via telehealth. And sometimes I think she's sitting in on patient visits and then debriefing. And it's not the same, obviously, but she's trying her best. And then I've heard tell, or did you tell me about, you know how sometimes you can take a CPR course online and you actually like click on the chest to show how often you're going to do a compression.
Yeah.
So been hearing about things like that.
Yep. The e-simulation.
E-simulation. Right. So you have like a virtual dummy, and I know we don't have the technology for this, but you know, I could picture 20 years hence, maybe less, where we have augmented reality where the person can actually, the student can wear goggles or whatever and actually feel like they're at the bedside of a patient. And that could be something, but we don't have that now.
We don't have that system wide, but it is developed, and they are working on putting together curriculum plans to see about schools investing in. So there is the technology out there. There are several people that I follow on LinkedIn who they work with simulation type companies, and they do have this product coming out. So I think now it's a matter of, does this time let us know that there's no better time to invest in these technologies, because we don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, even if COVID-19 goes away, mutates again and becomes an effect, you know, doesn't affect us, what's the next virus that's going to come along?
Well, right. And, you know, some of the epidemiologists and public health folks I'm following are saying that COVID-19 might be a dress rehearsal for the big
the next
one
thing. Yeah, absolutely.
That we've been talking about, they've been talking about for 25 to 30 years or more, just like we've been talking about the big one in San Francisco. When is the big San Andreas fault earthquake going to happen? And it's going to happen someday. And the one in Seattle, you know, there's a fault line through Seattle. So there's a fault line through our culture and our society and our world right now, which is pandemics. And, you know, we've had Ebola, SARS, MERS, H1N1, HIV, AIDS. I mean, you know, the list goes on. And this is the biggest one since 1918. Look what it's done to the world economy. Look what it's done to nursing and medical and physical therapy and psych counseling education and medical students. Like, what the heck is going on with medical students? I've talked to some doctors and they're confused too.
Yep.
They don't quite know what to do. And, you know, I was listening to the New York Times daily podcast. It's called The Daily.
Yep.
And they do a deep dive every morning into some story. And the other day was this. It was 24 hours in a Brooklyn hospital, and one journalist was embedded in that hospital for 24 hours. And one of the stories was a medical student who didn't go home when he was supposed to because his mom was in ICU and failing and multi-organ system failure. So it's like, we don't only have people's education being disrupted and trying to figure out how to make sure they learn, we're also seeing like medical students getting sick.
Yep.
Doctors and nurses dying. So, I mean, this is serious. And
very serious.
We need all these nursing and medical students to get through school, pass their exams, and get licensed and get out there in the workforce.
Yeah.
But we don't also, at the same time, we don't want all these novice nurses and medical students and new doctors being cannon fodder for COVID-19. So we're in a really tough spot, Damien. And
yeah, we are.
You're an educator, and you've taught students, and you also work with people on passing the NCLEX. So you're in a special position to understand the many, many nuances of the situation.
Yeah.
So tell me some of the thoughts that have just been running through your head about either the NCLEX or prepping people to get through school and graduate. Like, what are some of the thoughts you have about potential solutions
Okay.
Aside from what we've talked about so far.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a bunch of different angles that you can take. And so, you know, I deal with a lot of people who are still determined. And of course, I'm their cheerleader and I'm here for them to still pass the NCLEX. And even in a scary time, they're still very eager to get into the workforce and they're looking
Good
forward
for
to
them.
The challenge. And I've had other clients who are terrified and they're like, what should I do? Should I even finish and become a nurse? I don't want to go and die within my first couple months of being a nurse because of this dangerous virus. And that's a valid concern.
And that's an ethical, moral dilemma on some level.
Absolutely. And, you know, ethical, moral dilemma, you know, ethical, I'm not sure if it fits into that category for trying to decide if you want to finish school, but moral, sure. It could be a moral dilemma. You know, all of us nurses signed up to serve and protect and heal, and but we also did it under the pretense of having the tools necessary to do it, right? So that's the biggest ethical, moral dilemma I think this whole thing has brought to healthcare is we all want to help. We all want to save lives, and we're bound to our patients when we accept those assignments. Mm-hmm. But we also did not sign up to be shortchanged with equipment, supplies, so on and so forth. And we know that there's tons of reasons why this is all happening, including just the sheer fact of COVID-19, just the virus itself, beyond all of the other money and politics and all that stuff, right? So having these people way, should I finish or I definitely want to finish has been really interesting for my process. And so a lot of what I have been focusing on for solution is really helping people understand that we have to take it day by day.
We do.
You can't get too far ahead with thinking about what are we going to do to fix these problems. So, you know, I tend to be that educator that I am and fall back on something that we've all learned in fundamentals, something that I don't think many people, when they first graduate nursing school, truly understand and know how to utilize to their fullest, and that's the nursing process, right?
I love talking about the nursing process, even though people wanna like retch when I mention it.
But for those individuals, and I work with some nurses who have been nurses for a long time and can't speak to the nursing process the way that I feel everyone should be able to. Mm-hmm. But the nursing process is really just a wonderful tool to take whatever problem is happening and figure out a way to make it better. Even in times of crisis, we can still find the good, right? Even in times of emergencies, we can still take time to appreciate, to take time to grow, you know, to love, to help. So even when we're taking our last breath, we have a choice. We can choose to focus on the positive or focus on the negative.
That's right.
And so I help people navigate through these tough times by helping them use the nursing process. So let's take an assessment of the situation. So
yeah, go for it.
You know, we'll talk about my current, one of my current clients. So graduated 2 years ago, didn't take the boards, started a family. That happens, right?
Yep.
Even with all of this happening right now, this person still wants to just go ahead and take the NCLEX and start working. Okay. I asked if it was for financial reasons. No, I have enough money. I said, okay, so what's the drive now? 2 years later, why do you want to go into nursing now? And it's because they feel like they're sitting on the sidelines and they're not contributing. And they think that they would be able to make more impact if they had the license so then they could start working.
Okay.
So of course, I'm like, I'm 100% behind that. That's, you know, very awesome that you're willing to do that. You have a small child at home. And so let me help you. Let's see if I can help you. But in session, I could see that this person is distracted. And so I'm like, okay, what's going on? And, you know, then the tears start coming and then the feelings of being overwhelmed. And, you know, I have a 2-year-old and, you know, it's been 2 years since I've looked at, I don't think I remember anything. And, you know, and then with everything going on with COVID-19, I'm scared for my family. I'm scared for my friends. And, you know, how am I going to transition into a new role as a nurse and deal with all of these things at the same time? And so I just simply reminded her We have to take it day by day. Focus on your current situation through assessment. So let's look at what's going on in your life right now. And so we did that. And so she ran through and she said, okay, I have food, I have water, I have shelter, I have my family, we're all safe. I have the means to, you know, start studying for the NCLEX. I have my test date. Everything's looking good. I'm like, right. She's working with me. So I'm going to help. I'm going to help her pass. And
yeah,
I'm like, okay, now what are the bad things? And she's like, well, I just named so many good things. The bad things don't really matter. I'm like, and that's really how you should look at it. You know, you have all of these good things for you. So focusing on the negative is really only going to prevent you from achieving your goals, because you're going to be stunned by fear about the what ifs. Take it day by day. And so not even halfway through the session, you know, her mood turned around and she just really started feeling more confident. And that's really what a lot of nursing education should be about, is helping people understand that they have the ability to excel. You know, I've shared with you in conversation before that there were some instructors that I had as a student that I didn't feel like they were the most supportive, or that they were compassionate about what they were doing. They're very intimidating and made me feel small. And I felt the whole time that that was a barrier to my learning. And so when I became an educator, I wanted to make sure that I would never do that to another person, that I would always help them achieve that light bulb aha moment. And if I wasn't doing that as an educator, then I shouldn't be educating.
Wow. That's a beautiful, powerful statement. And I love how you're talking about fear, because I keep talking over and over on this podcast about the grieving process, and we can get really stuck in fear and anger or depression. And some of my listeners might be tired of it, but you know, fear often has to do with, we are afraid of something in the future that hasn't happened yet. And just like, you know, if you look at the Serenity Prayer from 12 Step, I'm not a 12 Step person, but you know, it's, you know, you have the wisdom to know there are things you can control and things that you cannot control. You can't control certain things happening in the world, but you can use the nursing process to assess and say, okay, I need help studying for the NCLEX. Damian Jenkins is one person who could help me, and I could decide to invest in his very affordable services at the Nurse Speak and help make sure that I pass the NCLEX the first time. Now, yes, I'm afraid of what will happen to me once I graduate or take the NCLEX and get licensed and then go into the workplace. That fear could paralyze me. However, I don't know what will be happening with COVID-19 by the time I am ready and I get a job. So things are pivoting every day. We're standing on shifting sands, and all of our lives are shifting sands, right, Damian? So, and what I always say to people too is, like, you don't have to be ashamed to be afraid. You don't have to be ashamed that you're that you're depressed or sad. However, at the same time, you can use assessment actually to assess, okay, what am I afraid of? How salient and cogent is it? What can I control? What can I not control? And what can I do to let go of the fear and then move into inspired action? I always talk about inspired action, and her inspired action is to work with you and study and not worry about what's going to happen when she gets her license, because that hasn't happened yet. And I get into fear myself. I mean, I can get fearful or sad or absolutely. So, you know, so for the people out there, let's say there's a nursing student listening right now, and let's say she's going to, you know, University of Arizona or University of Colorado or something. And she's, you know, she's young, she's in her early 20s, and she wants to finish. And she has one more year of nursing school, but she feels like, I don't think I'm going to be getting the education I need now under these circumstances to really feel confident. So what does that person do to build their confidence? Like, where do they turn if they feel like they're going to graduate but not be up to snuff if they'd been able to do everything they would have done without COVID-19?
Yeah. So what I can say about that is many of us have amazing educations, right? And we still get out not feeling up to snuff. We still hit the floor running and are very insecure about our ability. But it's part of the learning process. Like, if you're not uncomfortable, then you're not growing, right? So I really feel that it's important to focus on the opportunity that you have now and then try to optimize and take full advantage of the opportunities being given. The way that the education is shifting, I think, is actually offering more opportunity for full involvement in the learning process, because you don't have to have that commute time. You don't have to sit at, in a desk and wait for a professor to walk in. You don't have to sit and stare at a PowerPoint slide and listen to someone read to you. You're an adult. You should be able to do your own reading and focus on the learning objectives at your own pace, in your pajamas if you want, or fully dressed if that's what makes you more productive. I think this opportunity actually right. takes away a lot of the nuances that provide barrier for learning. So, you know, I wouldn't really focus too much on the what ifs. That's that whole thing, being fearful about the what ifs, and focus on day by day. If at any point you're not understanding, you're not getting the objectives, you're not scoring high enough on your exams or your pre-test quizzes, because I know a lot of programs offer additional resources for you to test your knowledge before you even get to the exam, then, you know, ring the alarm, call for help, ask your professors, ask other classmates, reach out to people like me who, you know, have that expert insight on nursing education and how to prepare for the NCLEX and think like a nurse, because that's really all the NCLEX wants you to do, is to be able to think like a nurse. So I wouldn't say don't worry at all about you're not getting the best education, because right now, during this time of uncertainty, you're probably going to learn a lot more about the process than you will if you have those structured in-class sessions, you know, and everything is back to the status quo. So
that's, wow, that's an interesting perspective, Damian. And what I'm thinking about here is the notion of nurses need to be able to pivot and deal with whatever's on their plate, right? You never know when a patient's going to crash. You never know when you don't have the right size Foley cath, and oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Or I don't have a G tube. Hey, let's use that 16 French Foley cath as an emergency G tube, like whatever, you know? So you have to, nurses actually learn critical thinking, and they learn how to make do. And when I was going to become a nurse, or I was just starting school, my neighbor who was a nurse, and he'd been one for quite many years, his name was Oren. Oren said to me, look, if you're going to be a nurse, you have to know you're going to be a plumber, you're going to be a carpenter, you're going to be an electrician, you're going to be a counselor, a rabbi, a priest, a grief specialist, and you're going to be a clinician. And he said, you need to be prepared to do anything within your scope of practice, of course, to deal with the situation. And sometimes, as the plumber, you're going to have to figure out, okay, how am I going to use these tubes when they're not the right tubes, but I can actually do it safely, but I have to jerry-rig this, right? And it sounds like with COVID-19, a lot of jerry-rigging's happening out there. Like, I've heard some pretty crazy stories. And there's a lot of stories I haven't heard that I think would probably make my blood curdle or the hair on the back of my neck stand up on it. And I'm personally, I sometimes feel bad I'm not out there on the front lines, but sometimes I think, man, I don't know if I could really pivot and do that at this point in my life. However, we all have our contributions. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this pandemic is actually giving nursing students an opportunity to say, okay, here's a real world problem, and here's my real world problem in that context. And now I've got to do my best to learn as much as I possibly can, because this is what's on my plate. And once I'm a nurse, there's going to be all sorts of stuff on my plate, a lot scarier than this, because people's lives are going to be in my hands. So there is, I guess what you're saying, what I'm distilling from what you're saying here, which is very inspiring, by the way, is that we need to learn and internalize that nursing process, assessment, diagnosis, planning, implementation, evaluation, and then we go back around again. If the plan didn't work, we come up with a new one. And so if you look at your education and your learning with that, I guess you're saying that if what you're doing isn't working and you're not learning what you need to learn, come up with, assess the situation, correct, and come up with another plan, Right? Yeah. So let's look at the bigger picture for a second then. Let's shift gears as we slowly start to wind down. So at the bigger level, say the pandemic stretches, like say it resurges in the fall, it takes a little break in the right. summer, which may not actually happen, but we'll see. It all depends on humidity and heat and the virility, the virulence of the virus, because it's not like the flu. It's not the flu. So it is not the flu. And if anyone tells you it is, folks, it is not the flu. And it doesn't work like the flu. So anyway, I digress. So let's say the virus comes back and it's pretty virulent and spreading again in January and February. And the next mm-hmm. semester is kind of scuttled. Mm-hmm. But people are doing their best. So I've talked with people, or maybe you and I actually talked about this too, and I have pandemic brain, so I can't remember. And I'm also 55, so I have two excuses. So what if we looked at reverting to a model where it's not like the odd person who actually is able to get into a nursing residency because they're so competitive and there's so few. What if we had really, really robust nurse residency programs at dozens and dozens and dozens of hospitals, whether they're teaching hospitals, community hospitals, and we went back to this more very robust mentoring and mm-hmm. precepting of new nurses? And COVID-19 or not, I feel like nurse residencies yeah. can be really awesome, but they're not. There's not very many of them, are there?
No, and I think what you know to be true about nurse residencies and what's happening today has changed drastically. So a lot of institutions will still hold on to that title, nurse residency program, right? But really all that is in many situations is it's a year-long professional development focused program where new RNs who have been hired have to go to these workshops, work on an evidence-based, you know, project, but they may only go to, you know, a workshop once a month. It might be a total of 4 hours, and then they have maybe someone who circulates through on a weekly or, you know, every 2 week basis just to check in on them and see if they have everything they need to be successful. And that's about it.
So you're saying that these types of nurse residencies aren't really what I think of when I think of a nurse residency.
No.
Like I have a client who was trying to get into an operating room nurse residency program where he would actually be in the OR learning the skills and the tools and the strategies of working the OR. And he would be in there like being directly mentored hand over hand sometimes. Mm-hmm. You're talking about there's nurse residencies that aren't that.
Right. And so they're assigned to a preceptor, right? They're given their prime person that's going to be in charge of their ongoing learning. But we know with the way that nurses are scheduled, you're not always going to necessarily have the same preceptor. Or if your preceptor's mm-hmm. sick, you know, we're not going to make you take a sick day because they're not there for you. So you would be assigned with a different person, which creates barrier. Because, you know, each person teaches differently. And so there's a lot of gaps that yeah. I actually really was interested in getting into the staff development side of nursing education so I can fully understand, you know, the full picture. And there's a lot of gaps in the healthcare setting, in the clinical side. You know, a lot of it has to do with staffing. A lot of it has to do with scheduling. A lot of it has to do with the programs that are funded through the education department to have things like the preceptor workshops, which then, which to me is a fundamental requirement to expect someone to train another person. They should have to be able to go through a formal preceptor train-the-trainer program and get certified and validated on their ability to appropriately train before
yes,
they're thrown,
thank
before
you.
They're thrown a new person and said, you have to train them. Because we know not everyone is a good educator. Not everyone wants to be an educator.
And they might resent being set up as a preceptor.
And it happens more times than not.
I believe you, and I've heard it.
Yeah. And then some institutions try to, you know, put a Band-Aid on that and say, well, we'll give you $1 an hour extra, as if that's some kind of big hurrah. to inconvenience someone into a role that they don't want to do. Because just because you go to nursing school doesn't mean that you're taught to train.
And does that dollar an hour make you less resentful of doing it?
No.
No. So you're saying here then, I guess, that there's a fundamental issue with, maybe we could say, the codification, or is it codification, of the training and potential for certifying nurses who serve as preceptors, especially in like residency programs.
Oh, absolutely.
And if you were, like, if I deputized you right now, or crowned you like king of nursing education for the United States, which I think would be like an awesome idea. And if I had a magic wand, I have one somewhere. If I had a magic wand, actually, here it is. I'm going to grab it. I have a magic wand. I'm showing it to you on Skype right now.
Yep. There it is.
It's a real magic wand. It was given to me when I was in the hospital after having emergency surgery a couple years ago. So over Skype, I'm deputizing you and crowning you king of nursing education. So what would you do in a perfect world mm-hmm. with nurses coming out of nursing school mm-hmm. and needing to really like have a robust experience in that first critical, let's say 12 months?
Yeah, it has. So first of all, it definitely has to be a year-long program. And I think a lot of institutions understand that they need that focused kind of, you know, we know you're a new nurse, you're going to need a lot of mentorship and a lot of guidance to make sure that you're growing into the independent, autonomous nurse where you can take care of any kind of a patient assignment that is thrown at you.
Yes.
So it does start off at the basics. Again, you need to make sure before you even launch a residency program that you have all of the appropriate education staff in place. And we know that education across all systems, not just healthcare, education is severely underfunded and underutilized. And so they expect maybe one nurse educator for an entire nursing home to do all of the training, which is impossible, right? I'm fortunate enough to come from a institution that has several nurse educators per facility. And so we have really good coverage, which is nice. However, the nurse educators still within their roles can't be there every hour of the person's shift, the 36 hours a week that they're working, right? So we need to make sure we start by selecting people who want to be preceptors. That's the first step, is doing a survey to find out who's interested in training. Then they have to be carefully selected based off of their performance. You know, are they actually practicing up to standard? Do they have any disciplinary action against them? Have they ever been called into an RCA because maybe they've done, you know, an inappropriate intervention and caused harm to a patient? You know, are they a good role model for that individual? Are they on time? You know, all of these things, right? So we have to make sure that before we even put someone through the preceptorship program, that they're qualified to be a preceptor. Then put them through a robust train-the-trainer program where we are validating their communication skills, their assessment skills, you know, making sure that they understand how to measure success. So we have to teach them some of the adult learning theories and the things that we've gone to our master's programs to learn. But, you know, we're giving that information to them without expecting them to go to a master's degree. But we have to instill that information onto them, or else they're not going to be able to really gauge if this person is meeting the criteria of improvement or not. And we have to do a little bit more circling back. I think what's happening is, you know, we give these rubrics, we give the orientation guides, and we say, here you go. And then once a week, we might pull them in and have a coach conference or a counseling or, you know, a conference with the team and say, how are you doing? How do you feel? Do you need anything from us? Have you done this, 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 and this, and this? And we sign a form to track their progress. And although that's very helpful, and I've seen that it can really identify a lot of barriers, unless it's being followed consistently the same way, then things fall through the crack. And with things like COVID-19 and people being strapped and being pulled, you know, to the front lines or being pulled to do temperature checks for the staff and things like that, those coach conferences and things tend to fall to the wayside.
Wow, Damien. I mean, you've got to be king of the nursing world. I mean, this is like I mean, you have the beard, you have the royal presence. I can picture you in like a real nice king's costume with, you know, like the, you know, that like black and white, those the beautiful brocades around you. And yeah, I'm sure your husband would love that too. So, you know, this is brilliant. And do you actually have influence out there in the world, in the bigger nursing educational world? Are there people in higher places who you can actually influence with some of these ideas, which I think are absolutely brilliant? Can you do that, Mr. King?
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I have some connections, and you know, it always kind of tends to be the same conversation. It sounds great. Okay. It sounds great. It sounds great. It sounds great. How are you going to make it happen with this much money?
So it comes down to funding as usual.
It seems to be that's just the case on how the world operates in general. And sure, I mean, maybe one day when I'm well off enough and I could just be a public servant and not make any money, then I can start doing those things. But right now I have bills to pay. I have student loans that I need to pay.
The king has to pay bills? Yeah. Oh, come on, man.
This one does. So there have been plenty of people, my director even, who is 100% behind the ideology, who really wants to help move some of these ideas forward. I have worked on a lot of these projects. But, you know, at the end of the day, it always comes down to budget. Do they have enough money to invest in these programs? Can they secure the grants that would support these programs? And that's right. What I've been doing since I've been on the staff development side is I've been, you know, really working hard to try to get some of these programs up and running and to just improve some of these processes that are pretty easy to improve. It's just about consistency and documentation and following through and making sure everyone's on the same page.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so as we wind down, this is 2020, and in 2019, the WHO deemed this the year of the nurse and midwife.
Yeah.
Mostly, I guess, in honor of, on a certain level, the 200th anniversary of the birth of Florence Nightingale,
yeah.
Right? The mother, the godmother, the patron saint of the modern profession of nursing, which is widely, deeply deserved.
Yes.
So, and the WHO recently put out another 2020 study about the state of nursing. Mm-hmm. I have it somewhere on my computer. So my sense is that we need more funding to be able to do the things that the WHO is calling for.
Yes.
Right? It's kind of like when the Institute of Medicine some years ago announced that we needed a certain percentage of nurses to have a BSN by 2020. It didn't happen.
Right.
It was a high percentage. However, a lot of hospitals are now not hiring ADNs anymore. Mm-hmm. And a lot of great ADNs out there are having trouble getting decent jobs. Mm-hmm. And they're being pushed into BSN programs, sometimes very resentfully. So it sounds like we need an infusion of capital, basically,
yeah,
to be able to implement some of these really amazing ideas you have to actually make this happen. And I guess one of the questions that this is a rhetorical question, I guess, is the will there? Like, do we have the will to do this? And I know there also needs to be the will to improve medical education. And, you know, on every side, I mean, PTs, doctors, speech language pathologists, everybody. I mean, there's always room for improvement in education, right?
Yeah.
And to do augmented reality, we need money.
Yep.
The technology's there, apparently, to start doing the stuff.
It's there, but it is expensive. And, you know, it does take money to get these programs up and running. And so, you know, it's really hard to say there's a quick fix because there's not a quick fix, you know. But resources will have to be redistributed, period. That's the big thing here, is that we're going to have to take how we value things as a country, as a global health community. We're going to have to change the way we put value to things and then start putting the money in the places that matter the most. You know, we know
put our money where our values are.
Yeah. And we know that disease and illness and injuries are profitable. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
but is it the right thing to do to focus on disease management rather than prevention? You know, so we're going to have to shift our priorities and refocus and redistribute that wealth to say, okay, maybe the people who have profited off of people's chronic illnesses need to not be able to make such a profit off of chronic illnesses and reinvest some of their resources and technology and mind power to developing preventative medicine or preventative technology instead of solely, you know, marketing themselves to be the new splint for people who have arthritis, right? Or the new medication.
And that brings to mind what happened with tobacco companies.
Exactly.
In all the settlements with tobacco companies, that they had to fund education and all these different things to make up for all the chronic illnesses they actually caused.
Exactly.
So, right.
So it's more of, I think it's just more of a redistribution of the resources to maybe, and you know, it's a tough situation because you don't want to tell people how they should invest their money or how they should, you know, focus on whatever product or service they have. If they have a product and service that helps, then great. But again, we have these huge corporations that literally make tons of money off of the suffering of others and that they're not actually fixing the problem. They're just continuing to put a big Band-Aid on the problem and it's not really fixing anything. And then they have all the control at the end of the day as well because they have all the money. So it's a tough decision. There's no right answer.
Right.
But the resources have to be there because if we're not supported at the fundamental level, if we can't have the education in place to make sure that people are being supported as they continue their profession, whether it's at the student level or the professional level, then we can't expect excellence. And people are expecting excellence for nothing. And I'm sorry, but excellence has a pretty high price tag if you want all the things in place.
Doesn't it? That's brilliant, Damien. And you know, we have to wrap up, but you know, Lyndon Johnson, I think it was him, he coined the term the military industrial complex.
Yeah.
And then there's the term that some people on kind of in the progressive world say the prison industrial complex.
Yeah.
Right. And now we have in a way the medical or healthcare industrial complex. And you're right, distribution of wealth, basically distribution of capital, I guess, not wealth, but capital.
Sure.
And putting our money not where our mouth is, well, maybe, but putting our money where our values are.
Yeah.
And you're right. If we want excellence, we have to pay for it. And the students out there listening, or the ADNs in a BSN program right now, or Bridge MSN program, or PhD or DNP program, you deserve to have the best education possible. And you deserve to then have the mentoring, precepting, guidance that you deserve to be able to become the clinician or researcher or whatever it is you're going to be, an educator as a nurse and healthcare provider, that is possible. So you all deserve that. And the society deserves that as well, because in the end, what is having excellent clinicians and educators and researchers do? It saves lives.
Absolutely.
Right? So we're not just talking about helping people pass the NCLEX just because they can become a nurse. It's that they're actually going to like have an enormous impact on society.
Yeah.
So if people want to chat with you or they want to get in touch with you either about this stuff or they want to get in touch with you about your NCLEX prep and how you help people prep for the NCLEX. And I think our listeners can tell, you know, how brilliant you are. I know they can go to thenursespeak.com. So it's thenursespeak.com. And then it looks like, right, you're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn, just like me.
Yep.
Right?
That is correct.
So Facebook is The Nurse Speak.
The Nurse Speak.
And then Instagram.
The Nurse Speak.
And then Twitter.
The Nurse Speak.
Right. And then LinkedIn is Damien Jenkins, and Damien is D-A-M-I-O-N,
yep.
Jenkins.
Yep.
So please, if you're listening and you want to know Damien or connect with him or network with him, send him an invitation to connect on LinkedIn. And like I always say, personalize it. Say you heard him on the Nurse Keith Show. You know he's the king of all nursing education as deputized by Nurse Keith, and you want to, you know, connect with him. And please like his stuff, visit his website. Damien, you're brilliant.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate you being here. And thanks for helping so many nurses and nursing students and healthcare systems, you know, be as best, as great as they can be.
It's always been my pleasure to educate, inspire, and lead the charge. I really enjoy doing it.
Thank you, Mr. King. And we will be back soon. And thanks for being here with me.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening to this special COVID-19 bonus episode of The Nurse Keith Show. There will be many more to come. And remember, the show notes are going to be at nursekeith.com/nursing education. I hope you feel uplifted and empowered by this episode. And I encourage you to take inspired action every day to educate, inform yourself, your family, your colleagues, your loved ones, everyone in your community, and reach out to Damien at The Nurse Speak. The Nurse Keith Show is adroitly produced by Rob Johnston of 520R Podcasting, and Mark Happy Speeson is our stalwart social media ringmaster. I thank Mark and Rob for helping me get the word out and spread the gospel of nursing and healthcare and high quality patient care, especially in this time of the COVID-19 pandemic. Stay safe, stay informed, and be the nurse who does the right thing in the face of COVID-19. This is Nurse Keith saying adios till next time from beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico.